Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Before mammography, just a few hundred women a year were diagnosed with an early-stage breast cancer, commonly known as stage zero. Now, roughly 60,000 women are diagnosed with the condition every year, and many undergo more aggressive treatments than they do with more aggressive forms of cancer. Now, the thinking is changing. And those second thoughts were underscored by a recently published study that tracked 100,000 women and found that early detection did not affect survival. Joining us now is New York Times medical reporter Gina Colata. Welcome to the show, Gina.
Thank you very much for having me. It's good to be here.
First, the study, it looked at 100,000 women over a 20-year period. How was it conducted?
It's a national database. It's done by the Centers for Disease Control, and they basically or the National Cancer Institute. And basically, what they do is they just keep the records of women who've been having cancer treatments, and you can sort of track them over 20 years. And that's what this researcher did. He just tapped into this, it's actually a National Cancer Institute database, and said, what happened to the women who had this stage zero cancer or ductal carcinoma in situ or DCIS? Did they have mastectomies? Did they have lumpectomies? Did they have recurrences? What was their death rate? What happened to them?
There's been controversy about this before, right?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, a few years ago, there was a movement which never seemed to gain a foothold to change its name that didn't have the word carcinoma in it or cancer in it, because people said, we don't really know that this is a cancer. We don't know. You know, it might be a precancer. It might be sort of no big deal. And so we don't want to call it a cancer. That, you know, there are a lot of people who say calling it a cancer is not really accurate. Other people say, yes, it is a cancer. So there we are. It's been a controversy.
I called it a condition.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure that fits.
To do it. Well, it is a condition. It's what it is in people, the things that people traditionally call cancer, stage 1, 2, 3, and 4, are tumors inside the breast tissue. They're not confined like these are to the milk ducts. These are they're almost always way too small to be felt. Mm-hmm. That's why they're being found by mammography. And there's a thought that the few hundred women who had them detected in the years before mammography may have had a different type of thing altogether. They would have symptoms like nipple discharges and things. These women who are getting these stage zero diagnoses now, they don't have any symptoms. There's nothing you can feel. And what's kind of interesting is if you say, as many people did, that these are breast cancer precursors. Just like if you find a colon polyp, it can turn into colon cancer. You're finding this sort of the equivalent of a breast, that's not a polyp, a breast mm-hmm. something, a breast growth. And if you remove it, it will not turn into breast cancer. But what's happened is with colonoscopies, removing these colon polyps really has reduce the incidence of colon cancer. With DCIS, this other condition in the breast, removing the condition in 60,000 women a year hasn't changed the incidence of breast cancer. The other weird thing that they found in this study in particular was that there were quite a few women who had mastectomies, often double mastectomies, just sort of get it out of here. Mm-hmm. And one reason mastectomies were recommended is often when they would find these things in the milk ducts, they wouldn't just be like one little lump. They'd be like a little spread of things all over the place. And they said, well, we'll just take off your whole breast. That's the best thing to do.
Why not go to a chemo or, obviously radiation wouldn't be helpful because they couldn't target it.
They don't usually do chemo unless you have something. Well, they could do maybe hormonal therapy, but they don't usually do chemotherapy unless it's more advanced than this. This idea was just take it out just like mm-hmm. they take out a polyp if you have colon cancer, because you don't really necessarily have cancer yet. It hasn't invaded anything. It's still confined to the milk duct. It may not go anywhere. It may go away. It may just stay there forever. On autopsies, lots of women have this and never knew it, never went anywhere. So the thought was, okay, take off the breast. It's gone, just like you took out the colon polyp, and it's totally gone. Well, what was very strange was, there are quite a few women who had that happen. Not quite a few, but there were women who had their breast, one or both breasts removed. All the DCIS was gone, and they died of invasive breast cancer. It had spread, the author of the paper says, it had spread before it was detected. It wasn't like you're getting something early. His thought was, in the very few women, and it is very few, mm-hmm. who are going to have it spread, it's usually too late by the time you find it as DCIS. And for most women, nothing's ever going to happen to you. They looked at the death rate of women who had DCIS, and it was the death rate from breast cancer. It was, their chances of dying from breast cancer in the next 20 years were about the same as an average woman's lifetime risk of dying of breast cancer. It was not high. These women had a 3% risk of dying of breast cancer in the next 20 years. It was almost nothing.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest, we're talking about what is called, so-called stage zero breast cancer, DCIS. My guest is Gina Collada. She's a medical reporter for the New York Times. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. A new study has looked at the data from 100,000 women over a 20-year period, and they found that there was no difference if it was detected or not. So how are doctors responding to the findings now, Gina?
Well, there's kind of a mixed reaction. The main problem is that there are women that who is thought there is people are pretty sure there are some people for whom DCIS might maybe you should do something about it. And for most people, you're probably safe not doing anything about it, but you don't know which is which. And the same situation arose in prostate cancer, almost the identical situation. And in prostate cancer, what they're doing now is they're shifting more and more to just keeping, they call it active surveillance, monitoring these men and say, when you have early stage prostate cancer, saying, is it going anywhere? Does it? Maybe it doesn't matter if we wait and see. And it's turning out that that's turning out to be a more and more popular strategy. People aren't quite ready to do that yet with DCIS. Mm. The big fear is you don't want to make a mistake. You really, you know, and suppose people dismiss this too easily. On the other hand, there are people, the head of chief medical officer for the American Cancer Society says that he wouldn't be ready to abandon treatment without a big study saying it's unnecessary for most women. But on the other hand, he says he has no doubt that treatment has really been excessive for this very early cancer, if it's a cancer at all. There are people who want to start, who are starting, particularly one woman in California, Laura Esserman. She's starting a study. Women come to her and they say, I don't want anything done. I'd rather just wait and have you keep on doing mammograms and things. So she is following a bunch of these women. She's been following some of them for quite some time and asking, well, what happens if you don't do it? But most people say if you're going to go routes like that, nobody wants to waste data. You know, they don't want you to be followed and no one to ever know. Because suppose something bad happens, they'd want to know how many women are followed and it doesn't work out well. And then they also would want to know how many women are followed and they're fine and nothing ever happens to them in their lifetime. They would be better off if they'd never had that mammogram and even known they'd ever had it.
All right. So I don't understand. Why can't they do that? Because there aren't enough women
there
doing
are,
that?
Well, there aren't that many doctors who've been willing to start these studies and take that step.
How well informed are women about when this happens, when they've been diagnosed with DCIS, this scattering of precancer cells in the milk duct of their breasts? How many of those women understand fully everything you and I just have been talking about? How well informed are they?
It's really hard to know. When you talk to women, you know, usually you talk to women who've been scared to death. And if someone says you have something that might be a cancer, you know, I can imagine how unbelievably terrifying it is. We just had in New York the girlfriend, Kathy Lee, of our governor, Andrew Cuomo, mm-hmm. had DCIS and decided to have a double mastectomy. She says her doctors told her that she was a walking time bomb. Now, if that's what her doctors told her, that's unbelievably scary. You're a walking time bomb?
But the question is, is it true? That's
no.
the question,
well,
right?
Well, that's the question. It's, you know, if you look at these data, the answer should be, for almost everybody, no, it's not true. And no, there's no rush. You do not have to do something this second. You're not in danger of dying tomorrow. And you can explore your options. You can talk to more than one person. You can talk to people who are willing to let you see what watch and wait, as they call it, watchful waiting. Or you can talk to people who say, you know, it's safer just to have a lumpectomy and maybe radiate. Some people do radiation, some don't. So you can talk to people on all sides of this thing. But it's very hard to say to a patient, you make up your mind. I mean, you're the patient. It's if you're in this terrified situation, how are you supposed to make up your mind if the doctors and the scientists can't make up their minds?
Well, there's been a lot of changes, I think you went on your report to say, about how we view these, the cellular structure of cancer anyways now.
Right.
I say we as if I view it in any way, but you know, how the scientists view it has changed a lot in the last 10 years.
That's right. That's why this is such a really, really difficult issue. I think it's a real burden to say to patients, you should be informed and you should decide for yourself. I don't know if it happened to, you know, I'm sitting here and I'm perfectly healthy and I can talk about this in the abstract. But if someone said to me tomorrow, hey, Gina, you've got this thing, you can imagine, you can go into this panic mode and you may not be in a position to be totally rational. And how can you examine the data anyway? We're not scientists. Really hard.
Let's hear from Steve in Clintonville. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hi. You were talking about, this type 0 cancer being found in like a milk duct, which could be cancer or could not be cancer. Why would they do a whole mastectomy instead of just removing like the small amount of tissues that are in the milk duct, like you said, like how they remove a polyp out of a colon instead of just like removing a colon? I mean, I understand, like,
it's a great question. Here's how the whole thing evolved. Originally, when they first started finding DCIS, they said, you know, it's not like one spot, like a colon, like a polyp in a colon. It's spread along the milk duct. It seems to be, you know, if you see it one place, you'll see some other ones scattered all over the place. Let's just take off the whole breast. And meanwhile, women who were getting more, who were having more advanced cancers, they were saying, you know, we don't have to do a mastectomy. We can do a lumpectomy. And people started saying, isn't this ironic? Something we don't even know if it's cancer, and we're taking off the whole breast, and things we do know it's cancer, we're doing a lumpectomy. So doctors started getting more and more comfortable just doing the equivalent of a lumpectomy, as you just suggested. No one ever did a study with DCIS like they did with more advanced cancer to ask whether the two treatments were equivalent or not. So we're now in a situation where some doctors say, you know, it's safer just to take your whole breast off. And other doctors say, you know, we've been doing lumpectomies for this for quite a while. Same thing with radiation. And does radiation help? Who knows? So it's been kind of understudied. The treatments have been decided by analogy with more advanced cancers. The only cancer that kills you is the cancer that spreads throughout your body. And these cancers are confined to a small area. They haven't spread. So it's really not clear what to say or what to do.
Well, I guess we'll continue to follow the story. Gina Collada, thanks for joining us today.
It was great talking to you. Thank you so much. I wish I had some answers. Thank you.
Gina Collada, she's a medical reporter for the New York Times. Thanks to Steve as well for his question. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 2013, less than 62% of Ohio children 19 to 35 months old had all the vaccines recommended by the Centers for Disease Control. Ohio's new preschool vaccine law appears to be making an impact now. Recent data show Ohio has jumped from one of the worst in the country to one of the best states in the number of kids vaccinated against measles, mumps, and rubella. Joining us now is CEO of the American Academy of Pediatrics, Melissa Arnold. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne.
So what are the new vaccine requirements now for pre-kindergarten children?
So the change in the law that happened this past year has been that those students entering a child care setting or a pre-kindergarten setting are required to have the full series of CDC-recommended vaccines. So those are measles, mumps, and rubella. Those are chickenpox vaccine, the Tdap vaccine. So it's a broad series of vaccines that most babies get before the age of two, which is why you're seeing that big jump, or why we believe you're seeing that big jump over this past 6 months in terms of our rates.
And it has been a really big jump, which is a testimony to how many people have their kids in childcare and preschool.
It is, and I think, you know, there are some other things that have really gone on in the past year or two. You know, one, we had Autism Speaks, which is, you know, an organization that represents families of children with autism, coming out and saying, you know, the falsehoods that were spread by a physician who is now no longer even licensed around the linkage between vaccines and autism, completely not true. And Autism Speaks stood behind that, the statement of, you know, vaccines are safe. And so I think that really changed a lot of parents' perceptions about vaccines. It alleviated a lot of fears right there.
Were the autism scares, which have been, debunked now, were those the only fears, though? Aren't there other fears about vaccines?
About vaccines?
Yeah.
A lot of it is really just, you know, more of the autism scare. They're just falsehoods and misperceptions that people have, or, you know, they hear about on the internet and they don't talk to their physician, their pediatrician or their family practice physician and ask, you know, really tell me the truth behind vaccines, and the truth is, you know, they are safe and they are effective. Are there potential side effects? You know, there's a minute possibility of these small side effects, nothing compared to a child actually developing one of these diseases. So I think, you know, we looked at before, we used to hear a lot around mercury and vaccines. Mm-hmm. So that was originally, MMR was the vaccine that Dr. Wakefield, who was no longer a physician, that's the one he targeted. And then, you know, once that sort of waned a little bit, then it was all about mercury, thimerosal in vaccines, which is a preservative they used. Mm-hmm. So vaccines, we've removed thimerosal or mercury in all vaccines except one of the flu vaccines, but you're, you know, able to get it without the mercury as well. So I think what's gone on is the medical community has listened to, you know, fears that parents have and have tried to address those fears. They found with mercury, they don't think it's a harmful substance to be giving in the small amount that they were getting in vaccines. But to alleviate fears, they thought, you know, it's a preservative, doesn't need to necessarily be there. And, you know, let's get rid of that and make parents feel a little bit safer about things. But there's always going to be rumors and always falsehoods around something that is given to a child right at the time that they're developing. So the big series of vaccines, a lot of them are given in that first couple of years of life. Well, that's also when you start to see, you know, kids, whether they're developing normally or not. And so, you know, a lot of times people just make that causal connection, and there really is none.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a question or comment about early childhood vaccines, my guest is Melissa Arnold, CEO of the Ohio American Academy of Pediatrics. You can also check out our email address at allsides@wosu.org. Do you think what are the thoughts about the impact that this will have on the likelihood of outbreaks in Ohio?
Well, we're hoping to never see one of those again. You know, many people have focused on the Disneyland outbreak of measles. And actually, the cases we had here in Ohio, the outbreak that we had last year, was four times worse than the Disneyland outbreak. And, I think these things have all sort of the stars have aligned for people to really realize these diseases are not gone. We have not eradicated them like we have smallpox. You can still get them. It's, you know, incredibly important to not only vaccinate your children, because you're protecting them, but you're also protecting the rest of the community, because there are some people who can't get vaccines because of medical contraindications.
And known allergies.
Correct.
I'm dating myself here. But I got the measles. I got the German measles when I was a kid. There was no vaccination at the time. I don't remember getting that sick besides the spots all over me. But I remember my mother caught them from me, and she became very ill. What happens when you get the measles these days?
People react very differently to them. So a lot of people can relate to chickenpox as well. So some people had them. You know, I had them as a child, and they were really itchy and sort of annoying, right? But then some kids end up in the hospital with breathing problems and other problems because of things like chickenpox or measles. We know things like mumps cause deafness, or they can cause sterility in men. So there are lasting long-term effects of these diseases that, you know, aren't necessarily death every time. But those who are older and those who are the youngest, the infants, are the most susceptible to these diseases, and they can cause death, which is obviously the worst side effect of any of these diseases.
Are there still pockets of groups out there like the Amish that are not going to be up to the same levels as other parts of the community when it comes to vaccinations?
You know, there are. I think you find, if you look at data just around school opt-outs. So parents right now in the state of Ohio have three ways they can opt out. One is for religious reasons. One is for medical contraindications or allergies. And then the last is a philosophical exemption. And when we look at that data across the state of Ohio, we're seeing pockets in communities that are typically suburban communities. So they're not even the most at-risk populations that we normally target for a lot of health, you know, outcomes and public health efforts. Mm-hmm. But there are actually, you know, a lot of parents who are, again, reading misinformation online, reading blogs, not asking their physician what the truth is about vaccines and deciding to opt out. And it's, you know, it mirrors sort of mass hysteria in terms of, you know, well, I heard from this mom who heard from this mom who heard from this mom, so I'm not vaccinating my kids. So it's not even a certain sect or religious community. It's happening in just certain communities. And you can, you know, go to the Department of Health and find that information out.
Will people who don't get their own children vaccinated tend not to have been vaccinated themselves, or do we know anything about that?
You know, I don't think anyone has studied that recently. I think, you know, again, the opting out has more been in the last 20 or 30 years, mm-hmm. from what I hear, you know, from our physicians all the time, that it's more of a recent phenomenon around, again, you know, misinformation that's kind of been released. Because if you think about it, a lot of people remember back to polio, right, where people were lining up, you know, blocks after blocks to get that vaccine.
Right.
And so people used to have much more faith, I think, in them, but they were also much more afraid of the outcome, because something like polio, you could see the effects of what was happening if you caught that disease.
Everybody knew somebody back in the day. Now people don't know anybody. They've forgotten.
Right. So it's actually, you know, it's one of those things where you're almost punished for your successes because people aren't as afraid of these diseases as they should be.
And as far as the opt-outs go, are opt-outs allowed with pre-K? With this new requirement? Okay. But they're seeing a higher rate of participation anyway.
They are. And like I said, I think, you know, there's a couple of things. One is the new law that's gone into effect. And then the other is you're seeing a lot of things on the media. You're seeing people like Jimmy Kimmel come out and say, you know, this whole debate is ridiculous. We need to be vaccinating our children. You see a lot of media sources coming out and saying, you know, people need to be vaccinated. And then we've seen these outbreaks. And I think when the outbreaks hit, parents realize these diseases are not eradicated. They're still out there. They're still harmful. You know, we've had pertussis outbreaks in Ohio. And then when we've had the outbreak, then you see those numbers go up. Because once people realize these diseases are real, they're still out there, they usually then go ahead and vaccinate their children.
As far as vaccinations go, do they affect people differently at different ages?
In terms of potential side effects from
the
vaccine?
Yes, reactions, yeah.
No, when you see the reactions, they're basically the same thing across the board in terms of, you know, potential side effects. It doesn't seem to be, you know, age-specific, really.
Again, if you have a question about vaccines, my guest is Melissa Arnold. She's the CEO of the American Academy of Pediatrics in Ohio. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. why wasn't a law like this put in place a long time ago? How much politics is involved in this?
Well, so this rule had been in effect for many, many years in terms of the pre-K vaccination rates.
Okay.
And then what happened about 8 years ago was the administration at the time said how the law was written or how the rule was written. They didn't quite know if they had the authority to actually require them versus just recommending that they have them. So that's when we started to see the decline. So 8 years ago, we're number 3 in the nation for our vaccination rate.
Huh.
And then we dropped to 49th over that time, over those 8 years. And some folks have said, you know, a lot of daycare centers, especially the big national centers, the kinder cares that are out there, they were already doing this. They were making sure that those kids in those settings were safe. It was these smaller centers that weren't necessarily kind of following the guideline because it was a recommendation. It wasn't a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, these are small centers, high turnover, and they just didn't, you know, see sort of the importance in it. So all of a sudden we became, you know, the first state in the entire nation without this requirement. And, you know, we thought we have to change this. This is not right. It still took about 4 years to get this law changed. And again, I think because when we started to work on this, it was at the height of a lot of the misconceptions of vaccines still. And as we've seen that public tide change, I think we've seen people be more receptive to this law. And, you know, recently we just passed the meningitis mandate for older kids, for 11 to 12-year-olds. That passed in 3 months. I've never seen a mandate pass that quickly. and, you know, not in the state of Ohio. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But we had a passionate senator. Senator Cliff Height had a family member, his young niece, die of meningitis. So this was a personal cause for him, and he made sure everyone knew about it. And, you know, it went through much easier than I've ever seen. When I started at the Academy 10 years ago, we were passing the varicella law, and that took about 5 years to do.
Ohio State has a new policy, too. All new students attending at least half time with at least one on-campus course scheduled need to be fully vaccinated. Again, I guess that's kind of surprising when you think about it that it wasn't in place before.
I think a lot of people just assume that it was. And, you know, we knew that a lot of parents were going ahead and getting their kids vaccinated. Things like meningitis,
yeah,
they spread so quickly in a residence hall situation or a college campus setting. It's stunning to parents when they find out that it's not required of all students. Because, again, no vaccine right now is 100% effective. We rely on the herd immunity that comes from everyone being vaccinated. And so I think it's a terrific move on Ohio State's part to come out and, you know, be a leader in this area and say, absolutely, you know, if you're going to come on this campus, we want you to be protected, we want you to be safe, and we want your fellow students to be safe as well.
Okay. We have a couple calls now for Melissa Arnold of the Ohio American Academy of Pediatrics. Bob in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Bob.
It's Todd, I believe.
Todd? Okay. Sorry about that.
I have always had just a slight disappointment with the way vaccination has been presented to the public. If a person uses the demonstrative safe, safer, and safest, it implies that there are degrees of safety. And yet there are some repercussions, some side effects, as has been mentioned, of vaccinations. And I'm not implying that people should stop getting vaccinations to avoid getting a disease, you know, the side effects, so to speak.
But you think part of the problem is in the explanations?
Well, part of the problem is in the presentation.
Okay.
And the presentation that all is good, all is well, and all is fine, when to a reasonable degree, that's not exactly the case. And so it's slightly misleading. I think the public deserves the absolute positive 100% truth unvarnished, as opposed to try and shade things with, you know, different types of presentations.
Okay.
They're safe, safer, and they're safest, but there are also repercussions.
Melissa Arnold, what about that?
I think if you'd find many pediatricians, at least our members, are very straightforward and honest with families, and we've developed a series of brochures that actually address that exact thing. You know, how safe are they? What are the protocols that are followed before a vaccine comes on the market? What are the potential side effects? What is the percentage, you know, of side effects for that particular vaccine? And so most physicians who are regularly giving these vaccines have that information, and I think they are explaining it better to parents. And before, you know, when I was young, you just got your kids vaccinated. It wasn't a question. And people are questioning physicians, and they should. They have every right to do that. And physicians are now becoming armed with the information, the accurate information that that parents want and need.
Okay. Todd, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. Lisa in New Albany, you're on the air. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. My question was very similar to the previous caller. I mean, I know there's a National Vaccine Compensation Fund that's been set up, and for the fiscal year 2014, it paid out something like $750 million to people who had negative effects from vaccines. So my question is, when vaccines become mandatory, I mean, I know right now Ohio has some exceptions to it, but there's some states that are setting it up, so there's no exceptions, you know, except for medical. You know, what rights do parents have to deny them in that case if they decide that, you know, there is that very small risk, and there are people obviously in the compensation fund set up to compensate people, so there is a risk. There. And I guess I'm concerned about when we get rid of any of the exceptions and they decide that just to make it mandatory for everyone.
Okay. Melissa Arnold?
Well, you know, in the state of Ohio, like I said, right now we do have a philosophical exemption. Many have concerns with that exemption because it's not enforced the same way across the board. So some school districts, for example, or child care centers, you know, you come in and you don't have your vaccine forms in front of you. You don't have your schedule that, you know, you've had these shots done. Mm-hmm. And they say, okay, well, we'll just mark you down as opt-in. You can opt out, and then you don't have to have that back, you know, that backup data.
Mm-hmm.
And so then that's happening. And then there are other people who have, you know, genuine concerns. Maybe they have high allergies in their family. Maybe they know someone who's had a side effect and they're very concerned about it. And, you know, they should be allowed to have that right to opt out if they'd like to. We just want to make sure they're having an educated conversation with a medical provider, not, you know, online, not information that's hearsay and not 100% accurate. So what we'd actually like to see happen is have that particular part of that opt-out provision around philosophical exemptions to make sure that, like they're doing in the state of Michigan, that you would have to have a conversation with someone before you can opt out. And at that point in time, if that's what the parent still wants to do, they have every right to do that.
Is there any way, if it, maybe a reason people aren't getting vaccinated or their children vaccinated is because they think something does run in their family? They've had other people with bad reactions to vaccines. Can those kind of things run in families?
Well, you know, can they and do they and do people think they do is
right.
Sort of the question. So, you know, there's no, you know, statistical data that is showing that. It's kind of like autism. So originally people thought, well, you know, I had my one child vaccinated, they developed autism. I had my second child vaccinated, they developed autism. It's that vaccine. That's what's causing it. And what we found out was, no, autism is genetic, not a reaction to it causing some kind of medical condition.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the medical contradictions that happen, the bad outcomes, they're severe. So when they happen, you know, they can be severe. So when they happen, they tend to be something that is publicized. But think how often you haven't seen that actually publicized, because it's not happening in the numbers that people are assuming they are. A potential side effect from a vaccine can be soreness of the injection site, for example. So that's something that we even track in terms of, you know, complaints or potential issues or challenges with the vaccine.
Are there any regulations for vaccines to travel to foreign countries?
There are. So when you're going to leave the country and travel internationally, we always recommend people go to their local health department, and they have a very series of vaccines depending where you're going. I mean, you know, you're looking at things like malaria. If you're going over to the eastern half of the world right now, you're still seeing polio. So, and we're seeing outbreaks of polio. So things that people weren't vaccinated for, or maybe they fell into a gap where they weren't vaccinated,
mm-hmm.
you know, they're required to do so because these are, you know, scary diseases. They're not your typical cold, for example.
Well, Melissa Arnold, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate all your time.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, there's a new law in Ohio. It requires vaccinations for people with children in preschool. And also Ohio State University has a new policy. All new students attending at least half time with at least one on-campus course scheduled need to be fully vaccinated these days. We'll have more Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. If you thought Midwest winters were bad, try standing in minus 250 degree air by choice. It's called whole body cryotherapy, and people such as LeBron James and Demi Moore are doing it all for the sake of health and beauty. So, fancy fad for the rich and famous, or does it really work? Joining us in the studio is a director of the Athletic Training Division in the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at Ohio State University, Dr. Mark Merrick. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
What is cryotherapy?
It's the use of cold. Pretty simple idea. We've been doing it for millennia, but it's simply the use of cold for a therapeutic purpose. Now, there's a lot of different kinds of cryotherapy. In this case, whole body cryotherapy is where you literally put your whole body in a chamber, and we pump in really, really, really cold air, 250 Fahrenheit below zero, colder than you can really imagine, and just try to cause a physiologic change in the body.
Why is it okay to do it under those circumstances, but you know, if it was 250 below outside, you wouldn't recommend I run outdoors, would you?
No, that's maybe not a good choice. But fortunately, there's nowhere we go that's quite that cold. The reason you can get away with it is you do it for a really short period of time, just anywhere from 1 to 3 minutes in a lot of the treatments that you see in the literature.
That seems like a long time to me.
Yeah, I think it would be too. you know, in some of the cold things we do in the laboratory, people really comment about just how cold it is. And even when we do something as simple as an ice bag, you put that on the skin and within just a really short time, it's really uncomfortable. But your body does learn to adapt to that a little bit. I think your first time is a shock. And when you get in a cold chamber like that and you're breathing really cold air, you're amazed at how profoundly cold it really feels. But it's actually pretty safe and you're in there a short period of time and people actually find it kind of invigorating once they get out.
So what does cryotherapy do for your body?
Depends on what kind you use.
Okay.
In general, cold suppresses a lot of physiologic functions. Anything that you do when you make it cold, it runs slower. And most of the way your body works runs on enzymes. So when we get an enzyme cold, it slows down its activity. And we use that for advantages. But the stress of the cold can actually be a stimulus to cause other physiologic things. And in the case of whole body cryotherapy, when we put you in a chamber and get it really, really cold, and you're breathing that super cold air and you have that really cold sensation on your skin, it triggers some physiologic effects that, well, we're really just starting to understand but look pretty promising in some areas. Things like reduction of pain, improvement of recovery after exercise, even some mental health issues are starting to be addressed with whole body cryotherapy.
Now, the reduction of pain, isn't that just because you're going numb?
It is. It slows down how fast your nerves conduct impulses, and that can reduce pain. But it also gives you something else to focus on. You know, we know that if you've ever been stung by a bee or knocked your knee into a piece of furniture, if you rub it, you feel better. And that sensation on the skin sort of competes for bandwidth, if you will, on your nervous system with a transmission of pain, and you feel less of it.
And reducing pain is a real therapy, I mean, because if you're experiencing pain, it's causing stress.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, we know that—
It's not just about not feeling badly anymore.
Oh, no, not at all. In fact, we can take in the laboratory and we can use some counter-irritant chemicals and put them in or on your skin and actually induce a stress response in your body simply from the pain. Making pain feel better isn't just the feel better part of it. It can actually help you in terms of your recovery and in terms of some of the things that we can do for rehabilitation. If you have a lot of pain, it's hard for you to do rehab exercises. If we can address your pain and make it less, then you can do some of the kinds of exercises that are actually going to help you get better.
You know, it's kind of funny. I had a shoulder problem and they gave me a shot of Kenalog. Steroid in my shoulder, mm-hmm. and the pain went away so fast and so completely that I could not remember to do my therapy exercises. Just a thought. The pain was a reminder to me that I had work to do.
Yeah, you got to be really careful about taking all the pain away instantly because then people feel like they're a whole lot better. you know, whenever we use steroid injections in sports medicine and somebody receives one of those, we have to be really careful with what we then let them do because their problem hasn't gone away, but the pain has. And sometimes that pain is a useful reminder from your body not to do stupid things that are going to make you hurt worse. So, you know, if we were to inject somewhere around a tendon with a steroid, for example, we'll often put somebody non-weight-bearing on crutches for a while because we don't want them to further damage that tendon because it isn't repaired and it isn't strong, but it feels better. The thing we get with cryotherapy isn't quite that profound. It's not an instantaneous all of your pain is gone, but mm-hmm. your pain is lessened and in some cases lessened enough that it improves your ability to live your life or to do the things you need to do.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about cryotherapy now, everything from a bag of ice to these very, very low temperature chambers you can put your whole body into or put parts of your body into. If you have a question or comment, my guest right now, Dr. Mark Merrick, he's director of the Athletic Training Division in the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at OSU. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Are you studying these intense forms of cryotherapy at OSU?
I'm not working on the cryotherapy chambers, but a lot of my injury-related work with cryotherapy is about treatment of acute injuries. So we do some things in my lab where we measure intramuscular temperatures with some of the cold treatments that we do.
Uh-huh.
Some of the more recent things we've been working on are actually cold sprays. And believe it or not, cold sprays can actually get your skin colder than we get in these chambers and actually potentially have a little more risk to you than the cryotherapy chamber might.
How do differing temperatures factor into it? For instance, if you're going from minus 135 to minus 200 to minus 260 Fahrenheit.
The thing you have to remember is you don't actually get that cold. The air in the chamber is.
Okay.
So that's good because if we got you anywhere close to any of those temperatures, you wouldn't live very long. It would cause a lot of damage to you. The actual temperature of your skin is probably going to go down, about 5 degrees C. So you're going to go from 30 degrees C down to about 25 degrees C.
In the process of just a few minutes.
In the process of about 2 minutes, yeah.
Okay.
But the actual temperatures, you know, the literature that's out there that's studied these, most of it is European right now. And there's a couple of big research groups. There's one in Milan, Italy, that probably is the best group in the world. There's a group in France. There's a group in Finland. And most of the time, they're all using things right around 110 to 140 below Celsius. So in that, you're going to get a pretty intense shock in terms of the way that it feels. But we don't know a lot about the difference between trying to go below 140 or trying to be around 100. That's just something we haven't really studied much.
You know, cold temperature is something that we're often told about to protect our skin from because mm-hmm. it's not good for the skin. But cryotherapy is also being used for skin enhancement. I know you're not a dermatologist, mm-hmm. but just in general, with, you know, your experience in seeing what the therapy's impact does it have an effect on the skin? I mean, is it something that you have to be careful of?
I think its biggest effect is probably going to be on the skin because that's where you interface with a cold.
Right.
Fortunately, because of the length of the exposure and the fact that we don't transmit heat terribly well through the air, you're not in there long enough to get a damaging effect on the skin. But you are there long enough to get the skin to change temperature pretty rapidly and to trigger some different kinds of effects. And some of the things that we see are that maybe with some long-term exposure, by long-term I mean doing multiple sessions over multiple days,
right.
not in there for a whole long time at once.
Gotcha.
But we get some antioxidant kind of activity. We get some reduction of inflammation activity. And those have some potential for things in the skin as well as potential for sports recovery too.
So there are, you know, cryotherapy salons out there now that mm-hmm. people are going to by choice. Anyone can go to them if they want. What do you think people should think about when they're going to go do something like that? Should it be a bad injury necessarily or should it not be a bad injury?
The first thing I would say is I wouldn't go to it for an injury at all.
Okay.
The cold chambers, you're in there a very short time. We get a skin temperature change. You really don't get any change at all in the deeper temperature or in your core temperature. And it's deep and core temperature changes that are probably most important for treating an injury. So if you actually have an injury, I would really recommend you do something like an ice bag. There's some things you ought to be careful with there about if you're using ice out of your freezer, use a barrier between it and the skin so you don't get a cold injury. But the cryotherapy chambers and spas are really more about recovery and other kinds of things than they are about injury treatment.
So what's the difference? What do you mean by recovery?
When I have an injury, I have a big inflammatory response all at once. So if I drop a bowling ball on my big toe, I'm going to break my toe. I can't do anything about that. But my body is also going to see that tissue damage and cause a really big inflammatory response. And that inflammatory response is going to make that thing swell up and turn colors and cause me a lot of pain. It's also going to cause additional damage to some more tissues that weren't already hurt by the bowling ball. If I use cold with that, I can suppress some of that damage. I can help some of the swelling. I can help limit some of the pain. It shortens your time to recover. It's not a treatment by itself that fixes everything, but it helps. The recovery side is a little different. When I exercise strenuously, and I think strenuously is an important piece here. You know, if I'm doing a really light kind of exercise that doesn't make me sore, this may not help me. But if I'm doing intense exercise that can lead to some soreness, the literature tells us that these kinds of chambers used really quickly after the exercise, usually within just a matter of minutes and certainly within the first hour, have the ability to reduce some inflammation and some of the markers of muscle damage that we see from strenuous exercise. That's a little different than trauma. That's sort of exercise-induced soreness. And they can help with some of that soreness. They can help with a number of inflammatory markers that promote inflammation. They suppress them. There's some literature that tells us that some inflammatory markers that suppress inflammation are actually enhanced by this. We also see that some of the markers we use to tell us how much muscle damage have you had from exercise are actually suppressed a little bit. So it may allow you to get less muscle damage and less muscle soreness after a strenuous workout. If you're the occasional weekend warrior, that may not help you a whole lot. But if you're somebody who's engaging in pretty strenuous training on a really regular basis.
Like marathoners, triathletes, that kind
of marathoners, thing. Trail runners, ultra endurance runners, triathletes, all those kinds of athletes who are doing large volume and large intensity training over a long period of time, this may help you recover from today's exercise a little better to better enable you for tomorrow. It's probably the reason that you're starting to see some professional athletes start to use it.
It's expensive, like a lot of these kind of things are. Expensive meaning, you know, $50, $80 a treatment, that sort of a thing. But any recommendations about whether somebody should check with their doctor first or at least their sports doctor, that kind of thing? I mean, would you write a script for it?
Well, the thing you have to remember about these is that you are causing a physiologic stress to the system. The literature tells us these are really pretty safe for most people, but if you have some underlying problems like cold intolerance or Raynaud's or underlying heart disease with uncontrolled angina, this is not for you. If you don't have other kinds of health problems, these really do look pretty safe. And they've even done studies where we measure indices about heart muscle damage and we don't really see any problem with that. It's not causing a very severe stress. But anybody with an underlying health problem should probably talk to a physician before they would try anything like this.
And is it something that you use at OSU? I mean, that not you personally, but that is in use at OSU in the sports department, athletics?
We haven't used the cold chambers at OSU. They're really – they're still a little more on the fad than mainstream side of things. And they're not FDA approved as medical devices. In fact, if you look at any of the spas that are out there, they have big disclaimers everywhere that this is for health and wellness. This is not a medical device and it's not intended to treat, cure, or prevent any disease. That keeps them out of the FDA regulatory stream.
Which means it keeps it from being written as a prescription too.
Right. We do use cold therapy quite a bit. In fact, over in the Woody Hayes Center where our football team is working out right now, right next to the locker room, there's a great big cold soak tub where the athletes have free access to using that. We use cold tubs after practice regularly, and we certainly use a lot of ice and cold in treating injuries.
All right. Well, Dr. Mark Merrick, thanks so much for joining us today to talk about it. It's Dr. Mark Merrick. He's director of the Athletic Training Division in the School of Health and Rehabilitation Sciences at Ohio State University. Thanks to the All-Sides staff. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, produced this show, AllSides interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Thanks for listening. This is AllSides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.